Well, we're continuing in our 1 Thessalonians study. We're at chapter 4, verses 9 through 12. Now, concerning brotherly love, you have no need for anyone to write to you, for you yourselves have been taught by God to love one another. For that indeed is what you are doing to all the brothers throughout Macedonia. But we urge you, brothers, to do this more and more, and to aspire to live quietly, and to mind your own affairs, and to work with your hands as we instructed you, so that you may walk properly before outsiders and be dependent on no one. Now, we all know that there's a city in Pennsylvania named Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. Okay? I went to seminary in Philadelphia. The seminary is located along Chestnut Street, right where the sprawl of University of Pennsylvania meets the ghetto. So it was right where the kind of mix happening there. And in my 3 years there, there was very little of brotherly love that I saw in the city of brotherly love. Al, the Jewish guy that ran a deli across the street, carried a pistol tucked in his apron because he had been robbed twice and pistol whipped once. One day, a kid across the street from the seminary fired a shot in the seminary window and hit two students. Brotherly love, city of brotherly love. So the lack of love is almost proverbial when it comes to Philadelphia. If you talk to those who are sports minded and you're figuring who are the worst fans anywhere, you know, Philly's somewhere near the top, usually number one. They boo their own players all the time and all sorts of things. So they have a bad reputation for unsportsmanlike behavior. It's a tough town. Ironic that it should be called Philadelphia. Well, that's the word that Paul uses here concerning brotherly love, is the word from which we get that name. But he uses two different words here in this one verse. Concerning brotherly love, fellows, you have no need for anyone to write to you, for you yourselves have been taught by God to love one another. And these are the two words for love that you're familiar with. The first one related to that Philadelphia term. The other is the word agape that we have all heard about. Now, some have tried to insist on a clear, total distinction between the two words. Agape being the kind of love that God has, and Philadelphia word is kind of friendship among humans. So that famous exchange after the resurrection between Jesus and Peter would read something like this. Peter, do you love me with God-type love? Yeah, you're my friend. Do you love me with God-type love? You're my friend. Peter, are you my friend? Yeah, you know everything. You know I'm your friend. That strict kind of distinction between the two words really can't be maintained. Even here in our text, Paul says, let's talk about this Philadelphia-type love that you already know about. Why? Because they've been taught by God how to agape, how to love one another. It doesn't read as though there was this radical distinction between the two. Interestingly, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 16, if anyone has no love for the Lord, let him be accursed. Well, the word he uses there is the word from which we get Philadelphia. You would expect agape. Or conversely, he says in Revelation 3:19, those whom I love, I reprove and discipline, so be zealous and repent. His love for his own there is expressed in that Philadelphia type word. So there are times that the two words are used kind of interchangeably. That real sharp distinction between the two is not necessarily correct. But there must be some distinction between the two. Peter writes in 2 Peter 1, for this very reason, make every effort to add to your faith goodness, and to goodness knowledge, and to knowledge self-control, and to self-control perseverance, to perseverance godliness, to godliness brotherly kindness, and to brotherly kindness love. Well, that's those same two words again. And if there's no distinction, Peter is simply repeating himself at the end. So there, there must be some distinction, but not this kind of distinction. And if you examine it a little bit, the Philadelphia word has somewhat of a familial aspect to it, a love within the family, and at times it carries with it a good bit of emotion and that sort of thing. Agape, on the other hand, is described in 1 Corinthians 13 as a manner of behavior, patient, kind, not keeping a record of wrongs. Now, it doesn't mean that agape is totally devoid of emotion, but that emotion is not the primary focus of it, rather a form of behavior. So Paul is saying that they need to practice this brotherly love because they have known and have experienced God's love toward them. God taught them to love, so now they need to carry it out. Now he goes back to the argument that he's made a couple of times already in the book. You're doing it, now do it more. Look at what he says in verse 10. For that indeed is what you are doing to all the brothers throughout Macedonia. But we urge you, brothers, do this more and more. Now, how did they express this love to those in Macedonia? Well, we're given very little information on what they had done. As far as we know, there were three churches in Macedonia: Thessalonica, Philippi, and Berea. Was Paul being extreme when he says your love throughout Macedonia? Well, I don't think we should assume that the three churches we know about were the only ones that were there. I don't assume that we have a biblical record of every church that had been established during the apostolic era. There certainly could have been 5 more, 10 more. I doubt it, but maybe even 50 more churches throughout Macedonia. We just don't know. But Paul's statement does kind of lend itself, though, to there being more than just those three churches, because they were showing love throughout Macedonia. Now, how they were expressing that love to the others isn't explained. Perhaps they were sharing resources, giving a safe haven to those who were traveling, going to other cities, encouraging them in the faith. These and really many, many other things might have been what was going on. Whatever it was that they were doing, Paul wanted to see it more and more, to show this love to others. And that should raise for us a series of questions. How well are we doing when it comes to loving one another? First, here within our own congregation. Do we love one another? Are we doing it more and more? How about love for believers in other churches? Is that happening? How about love for your neighbor next door, down the street? Questions that we ought to consider are how can we do better on that? How can we love more than we are now? Take time to get to know your neighbor. Keep an eye out for the ways that you can help them. I don't know who this guy is. Maybe you've heard of Terry Muck, but he wrote in a magazine, Men of Integrity, back in 2009. He says, a man who had no interest in spiritual matters related casually to the Christian that lived next door. They'd talk over the back fence, they'd borrow tools and that sort of thing. Then the non-Christian's wife was stricken with cancer, and she died 3 months later. Here's part of a letter that he wrote afterward. I was in total despair. I went through the funeral preparations and the service like I was in a trance. After the service, I went to the path along the river, and I walked all night. But I didn't walk alone. My neighbor, afraid for me, I guess, stayed with me all night. He didn't speak. He didn't even walk beside me. He just followed me. When the sun finally came up over the river, he came over and said, "Let's go get some breakfast." I go to church now, my neighbor's church, a religion that can produce the kind of caring and love my neighbor showed me is something I want to find out more about. I want to love and be loved like that for the rest of my life. So you don't have to have a whole bunch of clever words. In a situation like that one, there's really not much that can be said that makes a whole lot of difference anyway. To love our neighbor, we need to take time. We need to show that we care about them in their particular situation. And depending on that situation, it can be costly in both time and resources. Now, he wants them and us to abound in love more and more. We must never get to the point of where we think, well, I showed love to that guy, I'm done with that, let me go on to something else. No, it's more and more. Jesus taught us to love as he has loved us. And he doesn't get tired and weary of loving us. He gives and gives and gives. We need to grow in this so we too will be doing it more and more. Kids, let me talk to you. This has probably happened in your house. Let's say you or one of your siblings get sick and you're running a pretty high fever. And it's getting up 103, 104. Do your mom ever take like a washcloth and put cool water on it and put it on your head? That ever happened in your house? People don't do that anymore. but if it doesn't help, then maybe a second one on the back of your neck. And keep changing them so it always stays cool to try and keep the fever down. Then I've never seen this, but I've heard of this being done too, that if both of those are there, front and back, if still high, then sticking a cold one under each arm, trying to bring the fever down. Now, let's say that was happening and did one on the forehead and didn't help. Would you just give up after 5 minutes and say, well, I've done that, we're not going to do that? No, you keep doing it. Now, you may, if it keeps going up, you may end up in the hospital or something, but you keep doing it, and you keep doing it until the fever starts coming down. That's what it is to love someone. You keep doing what needs to be done in order to love them well, and we do it more and more. That's what Paul's talking about here. About the more and more of our love for each other. So it's not a once and done. You keep doing it and keep adding to it and watch what God will do. Now, I think we would all agree that we need to be wise in the help that we give. We're not called to enable someone's sin or encourage them to continue to live an irresponsible lifestyle. To do so is really not to love them. You can do things like that really just to make yourself feel better or to get that person off your back for some reason, and none of that is really love. I do think it requires that we do stuff that we don't necessarily feel like doing. And it's often good for us to get involved in something, even when our heart isn't in it. If you know it's the right thing to do, it's not hypocrisy to do it when your heart's not in it. Because in the doing, your heart may catch up with where it ought to have been anyway. I'm sure the Good Samaritan could have had any number of reasons why he should not get involved and just pass by the injured man like the priest and the Levite had done. He had stuff to do. I'm sure he had an agenda. But he didn't. He surrendered himself to the inconvenience and perhaps even the danger of getting involved. Did he know that the guys who beat up the man weren't still lurking behind that rock over there? No. And it cost him significant time and apparently significant money to help the man, but he showed genuine love for a total stranger. According to Jesus, he proved to be the real neighbor of that man. Well, Paul continues his exhortation. He says, aspire to live quietly and to mind your own affairs and to work with your hands as we instructed you, so that you may walk properly before outsiders and be dependent on no one. Leon Morris lays out an introductory paragraph here to these verses that I think is helpful in our understanding of what Paul is saying. Morris says, the Thessalonian believers had learned very well that the Lord would be returning in mighty power, and evidently some of them felt it would be very soon. Accordingly, there was no point in continuing some steady job. It was much more realistic, they evidently reasoned, to be about the business of proclaiming the near end of the world. If they had need of this world's goods in the meantime, why, there were others, Christian brothers, who could be relied on to come to their rescue. It may be no accident that verses 11 and 12 follow a section in which Paul stresses brotherly love. This kind of thing can be done from a sense of serious purpose, but human nature being what it is, it can easily degenerate into downright laziness and idleness. People can be so taken up with the spectacular, with the excitement over the near approach of the Lord, that they pass over the important things of everyday life. Paul gives attention to such matters and counsels these brothers to mend their ways. So if they're all, Lord's coming, and just giving up on all of their responsibilities, you can understand why he says, get to your own business, deal with your own stuff, work with your hands, and leave off all that other stuff. So he's not contradicting himself there. He has just urged brotherly love that requires interaction with others. Now he says, make a goal to live a quiet life. The two really do go together if we understand the information that Morris has given us. They had been checking out on life and responsibility to wait for Jesus' return. That we must not do. We're not to be busybodies messing in someone else's stuff all the time. But we are to love and care for them. We must also take proper responsibility for our own lives, lest we become dependent unjustly on someone else. Now, age or illness or poverty can put you into a position of being dependent. That's certainly not something I welcome, but I can see it coming. I'm no longer able to do the kinds of manual labor I used to do. I used to do almost all my own car repairs. Not anymore. I used to be able to paint houses 9 hours a day, lots of times spending all day on an extension ladder. There ain't no way that's happening today. My body just doesn't hold up. At some point, as the aging continues, I'll become more and more dependent on other people. But according to Paul, I still need to do what I can. I need to mind my own affairs. I need to work with my hands. I shouldn't expect someone else to do something I can do. The tendency of some is to give up too easily and not carry their own weight. But you can still take the trash up, Tim. A fellow I knew in college used to talk about his grandfather. Lived up in the boonies of central Pennsylvania. At 92, he was still digging graves by hand with a pick and shovel. Now that's extreme. I mean, that's really extreme. But we need to press on in order to take care of ourselves and not make someone else deal with stuff that we can and should be dealing with. The entitlement mentality is growing in our culture, and that's not good. People expecting to be taken care of by others, usually by the government in some way, will not serve a good purpose, and it clearly goes against what Paul is saying here. The quiet life seems to me also that we need to find time to rest and to relax. Just not try and fill every day, all day, with as much stuff as we possibly can. So balance must be struck. We need quiet and rest, but we also need to work with our hands so that we do not bring a burden on others. Now, when Paul says work with your hands, I don't believe he's excluding working with your mind. In his day, there were far more involved in manual labor, but his point is work. Do something. Do it for gainful employment, but also do stuff for which you don't get paid. And whether that's mental stuff or physical stuff, he's saying be involved, do stuff, get things accomplished. Kids, let me make another point with you. You should be involved also in family chores, in the stuff that needs to be done around the house. You can help, and you should. Be useful. Don't grumble and complain about having to do stuff all the time. Try and be helpful to your neighbors also. That's a good thing to do. It's a way to show love to them, and it's a way of being useful. If we can avoid it, we shouldn't be dependent on others to sustain our lives. Now, there's always cooperation that's necessary. We don't live as hermits. We live in community, and we help each other, but yet we still need to be pulling our own weight. Paul gets at this in Galatians 6. He says, "Carry each other's burdens, and in this way you will fulfill the law of Christ. If anyone thinks he is something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. Each one should test his own actions, then he can take pride in himself without comparing himself to somebody else. For each one should carry his own load." So he starts by saying, carry each other's burdens, then carry your own load. There is a slight difference in the terms that he uses, and some construe it that the first burden is a heavy burden that you can't carry by yourself. So you bear one another's burdens when it's more than a guy can handle. And the word that he uses in verse 5 refers to a guy's, to his backpack, essentially, something that's easily borne by a single individual. So we help one another when it's necessary, but when you're able, you carry your own load. Notice what Paul says, aspire to live quietly, to mind your own affairs, to work with your hands as we instructed you, so that you may be able to walk properly before outsiders and be dependent on no one. Now, it's important because we live our lives before the world to some extent. If we come across as lazy moochers, that's not the image that we ought to be portraying, nor is it what the Lord, through Paul, wants us to do. We impact people even when we don't realize it. So we need to be aware of what we are showing to the outside world. This story went around on Facebook probably a couple years ago. It's possibly fictional, probably fictional, I don't know, but it makes the point, okay? You may have seen it when it went around. A young woman was driving very aggressively, and she was shouting at other drivers and giving gestures and things. And a policeman had been following her for a while, and finally he stopped her. And in the conversation, the policeman said, "I stopped you because I thought the car was stolen." I said, "Stolen?" He said, "Yeah, the way you're behaving didn't correspond to the Jesus sticker on your bumper. I didn't think you were the owner of the car." So whether fictional or not, the story makes the point that our lives need to match up with our profession, and lazy moochers doesn't go along with belonging to Christ. So do we portray the proper behaviors and attitudes as we interact with the world? That's a very broad question. It touches every aspect of our lives. Paul's point here is that we not ought to be thought of the kind of person that doesn't pull his own weight, that he's always living off of somebody else. Remember, this is in the context of their expectation of the return of Christ. But regardless of the thoughts and motives behind the copping out of responsibility, we must not do it. If I quit doing something because I think Jesus is returning, that doesn't mean that the guy across the street from me is going to know my motive. All he's going to see is my behavior. And it's not good. If we're going to carry out brotherly love, Paul urges it again and again, and he wants it more and more, as he says here. We certainly need to bear our own burden and then reach out and help bear the burdens of others. Our love must be rooted in the love of God for us that we've already received. We need to try and reflect His love then around us in whatever way. I mean, He so loved the world that He gave His only Son. He gave the indescribable gift. So our hearts should fill with gratitude and thanksgiving, so much so that we desire to give to others. We should be so enthralled with the love of God for us that we desire to love those around us. I think you would all agree with me that Thanksgiving needs to be every day, not just a national holiday. Paul stresses this in Philippians 4, where he says, "Rejoice in the Lord always." Again, I'll say it, rejoice. It's when we are thrilled with the love and mercy of God to us that we will find avenues to love and to help others. That is, if we function with at least one eye open. You have to be looking for ways to help others, but our hearts will push us toward that when we're rejoicing in the goodness of God. We were helpless in our natural state, lost in sin, dead in transgressions, we're told. But God, who is rich in mercy, sent His Son to live, die, and rise again for us. He fulfilled a perfect redemption, and we're the recipients of that grace. And by faith in Christ and His work for us, we're accepted as righteous by the heavenly judge. We have so much to rejoice in. That worship and rejoicing should then lead into a deep love for others and a willingness to help in their time of need. We can't turn a blind eye or a helpless hand. So let's keep Christ first and foremost in our thinking. Let's be continually grateful to Him and then be grateful for all He has done with the provisions that God has granted us over and over and over again. And then in those things that we have received, let's share what we've received with others, whether it's material goods or a helping hand in some way, or even just a love coming from a caring heart. So Paul speaks to us as much as he speaks to the Thessalonians. He wants that kind of love happening in the church, and he wants to see it growing more and more and more. So that would call to us to join in doing that. But in order to do it, we need to be reflecting more and more and more on the love of God in Christ to us that was expressed in our redemption. Let's come and fellowship with our Savior at His table.